So now I get to introduce our speaker, one of our good friends who's been coming here for years now. I just love Michael so much. Michael is the chaplain at the Sims Mann UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. He's a two-time TEDx speaker, and he speaks extensively to healthcare professionals, patient populations, and faith communities across the country. He's also worked as an activist and educator addressing anti-LGBTQ bias in the larger community for over 30 years. Michael was recently inducted into the UCLA Semmel Institute Eudaimonia Society in recognition of having lived a meaning-driven life. He has 4 volumes of CDs available for purchase, and we can contact Michael through his website, www.michaelesselin.com. Thank you so much. Let's give him a warm welcome.
Thank you for the nice welcome and introduction, Bonnie. It's always a great treat for me to be here. The well-known Buddhist author and teacher, Pema Chodron, offers us this in her book, When Things Fall Apart. I used to have a sign pinned to my wall that read, only to the extent that we expose ourselves over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found in us. It was all about letting go of everything. I invite you to think about 4 or 5 things that make you who you are. That if anybody's going to know you at all, they're going to know these 4 or 5 things about you. That you're a talented athlete, you're a gifted artist, you're passionate about politics or your faith community, or you're a devoted grandparent. Perhaps you're known for your beautiful physique and your great head of hair. That would be me. Imagine none of that is true anymore, or not in the same way. Who would you even be then? Is there an essential you who dwells beneath all those labels with which we would identify ourselves, all those hats we might wear? What's more, is he or she worthy of love? Is he or she capable of giving love? As painful as it may be to entertain those questions, they do reflect the most profound spiritual journey through loss, toward essence, if you will, that which is indestructible. It's a journey that so many cancer patients must take in a compressed, accelerated kind of fashion, watching piece by piece of one's identity slip away. If I'm no longer the super mom who never misses a soccer game or a birthday party, who would I even be then? Am I even still the mom? The thing is, it's a journey we all must take. Life affords us each that guarantee that we will all lose everything. Everything we have, everything we are, everything we love. How do we make peace with that? Is it even possible? I sometimes wonder if one key to living a successful life might dwell within our capacity to come to peace with the inevitability of loss. And once more, might that peace even be a kind of gift, a blessing, giving us a glimpse every now and then of that which is indestructible? The Buddhists would caution us to be well practiced at letting go, that holding on, grasping, clinging are sure pathways to suffering. As an illustration, we only have to look at how so many of us are coping with this unfolding pandemic. How long is this going to go on? When do I get my old life back? When is it going to get back to normal? I am an avid swimmer. I swim every day, and I remember a year ago, March 19th, when my gym announced that because of the virus, they would be closing down for up to 2 weeks. 2 weeks? I can't live without the gym for 2 weeks? Oh, yeah? Just wait. I hear similar sentiments from newly diagnosed cancer patients sometimes. Can't we just go back to 4 or 5 weeks ago before this started? There's a kind of paradox, though, really, that while, yes, holding on can cause suffering, I find there's also life force in it, in the reaching, in the yearning, in the striving. Chemo infusion clinics are filled with patients who have signed up for guaranteed suffering, for the possibility of more time, more life. Universities are filled with students investing in, striving for, creating the future. When we're young, the future is almost a member of the family, a character in our own biography. Look at how much attention and intention we invest in the future. When we get older, possibility diminishes right along with the future, and the past becomes a far richer member of the family. Memories, stories that might soothe us, bring us peace, or stories that might even haunt us, but either way, stories that offer the possibility of meaning. In the saddest irony of all, some of us will even lose those in time. How do we make peace with that? Is it even possible? What meaning is there to be found in everything that we're going to lose? I am not so arrogant as to think I have any answers at all. What I have are stories, both my own and those of countless patients I've walked beside, patients whom I would just as soon call my teachers. And I also have a growing faith at this stage in my life that drawing closer toward any paradox, holding the space for two competing realities to be true, might just offer a pathway to peace, if not wisdom, dare I say. April was a great gal, mid-40s, vibrant, vivacious, professional, a wife, a mom, two great kids. She got this exceedingly rare, exceedingly lethal cancer diagnosis that also happened to be horribly disfiguring. The doctors gave her that awful assessment, nothing more to be done. "Michael, I'm dying," she said. "I know that. It's the truth. But you know what? It's only one truth of many truths." Her openness to that statement, her willingness for it to shape the remainder of her days, was truly something to behold. And there are those who cling so valiantly to those one or two aspects of their identity that without them, life simply wouldn't be worth living. That clinging actually keeps them going. There's the passionate university professor who, by any reasonable standard, should never have been in a classroom, given how immunocompromised she was and how weak she was. But even her oncologist saw the truth of that situation. "I see that this is who you are. You're a teacher. You've got to teach. Go teach. Just be careful, okay?" I remember years ago meeting a young mother in her 30s, not long before she died, in the hospital. When I met her, she was busy writing a journal, writing letters to her then 11-year-old daughter to be read into the distant future. "Oh, that's so beautiful," I said. "No, it's not," she said. "I'm just nagging her into the future." Still, just being a mom to the end. Sometimes it might even be an object that we cling to so defiantly as some kind of remnant of an aspect of our identity we just can't release. Maybe an old wedding dress, maybe an old army uniform, an old ID badge from a long-gone career. Over the last few years of my mom's life, she was acutely aware that things would be wrapping up soon. And so she took to earnestly clearing out every drawer, cabinet, closet, letting go so that we wouldn't have to. When death finally came, things had been pretty much sifted down to the bare essentials, except for boxes and boxes, acres and acres of family photos, cards, letters, a few tattered old newspapers with historic headlines, JFK assassinated, that sort of thing. That last Saturday that we were packing up what was left of her life, I made a final pass through her bedroom closet. And in the darkness, high in the corner on the top shelf, I saw this old hat box. How had we missed that? I pulled it out and opened it. I couldn't believe my eyes. And I felt this searing stab of grief and wonder and amazement. It was the hat, this hat that had become legendary in my mind, her Donna Reed hat, I called it. She looked just like her when she wore it. A little pillbox covered in champagne silk leaves, each one tipped with a tiny seed pearl. She bought the hat, I remember, to go with a light blue brocade suit that she would wear to her best friend Janet's second marriage at the Desert Inn in Las Vegas, maybe 1962 or so. My mom was quite the glamorous dresser in her day. Earlier that afternoon, in fact, I had come upon the photo of the wedding party in the original Desert Inn folder. There my mom and dad were seated at the table, so young, so handsome, so beautiful. My mom was the only one with a hat, that hat. I also knew that under the table were the most stunning pair of pointed-toe gold lame stilettos. I had always been fascinated with my mom's high heels, obsessed, really, surreptitiously trying them on. Even I knew better than to mess with those. But here it was, the hat. She had kept it. Though we had reminisced about those times, even about that outfit over the years, she never let on that she had kept the hat. For decades and decades and decades after letting go, saying goodbye to everything and everyone else, she kept the hat. Why? Did she need it as some kind of touchstone, as proof that that time had been real, that that aspect of herself was still true, unwilling to surrender this last souvenir? It leaves me to wonder, what object will I cling to for no sensible reason as some kind of placeholder for some version of myself I will always want to claim as my own? I don't know. David Foster Wallace says, everything I let go of has my claw marks on it. And there are those who adapt to the loss. They find a new identity or a new version of the old one. Years ago, I had so many wonderful conversations with Randy over the last few years of his life. He was in his mid-50s, advanced colon cancer. Not long before he died, I was walking him out of the clinic. We're still chatting when we get out into the hallway, and up walks another patient, gingerly making her way to the front door of the clinic. Randy says, excuse me, Michael, just a minute. And he goes, and he holds the door for her. Big smile on his face. There you go, sweetheart. He came back to me and he said, you see, Michael, the way I see it, that's my job now, to be kind. That's what I do. Now, Randy's professional life was one that had been animated by intense financial pressures and competition, commercial real estate. It had all been refined and distilled now, down to that as one who shows kindness. Cancer had robbed him of so much, but it didn't take away that career opportunity. It didn't take away that place to still find meaning. Kate, in her early 60s, was newly diagnosed with a recurrence of breast cancer, now stage 4. Kate was a spiritual seeker, an artist, a musician. She played cello in a local chamber orchestra. While raised an Episcopalian, she converted to Judaism much later in life, but not because of marriage or any such conventional reason, but because she said, I love the humor in Judaism. And besides, there's no hell. Any articulation, though, about who or what is God, how does prayer work, what happens after we die, was simply left undefined because she experienced her spirituality in community, playing music in community, praying in community. She didn't pray when she was alone. She also shared with me that she had been a survivor of childhood sexual assault, an experience that left deep wounds, to be sure, but not the least of which was a crippling fear of dying. And the essence of that fear was, Michael, what if I just disappear? There it is, ultimate loss, disappearance. I asked Kate if she'd ever had what any of us would call a peak spiritual experience. Oh, yes, she said. Playing a big, lush piece of music like Handel's Messiah. I got to play that once in Cleveland. Full orchestra, chorus, the works. It was transcendent to be in the center of the creation of all of that music. Kate, you just told me that your biggest fear would be that you would disappear. And yet your peak spiritual experience is one in which you disappear, if you will, into the creation of that music. It couldn't possibly be about you and your cello at that moment, and yet without your cello, the music would not have been the same. What if dying is like that? What if the other side is like that? Surrendering into this larger harmonic reality in which our little voice is an inextricable piece of the whole. She exhaled into that. She breathed into that, sighed into that. Sometimes we need to summon our imagination to come up with new metaphors and images when we find ourselves immobilized by the fear of loss. I love to hike, and for decades I have made a nearly annual pilgrimage to Yosemite because there's one hike there that has simply given me my life back, no other way to put it, more times than I can count, often times of great distress. About a dozen years ago, I came upon such a time, devastation, really, spiritual crisis, in fact, which I would define as a time of great loss. Everything I had believed in and trusted seemed to collapse right out from under me. And at first I thought, maybe you better get up to Yosemite, do that hike, try to transcend it, climb out of it, but it just didn't feel right. And the more I thought, you know, Michael, you've always wanted to go see the Grand Canyon, hike to the bottom, not getting any younger. What if instead of trying to climb out of this, you climb down into it, into the earth, see what might be there for you? So that's what I did. For any of you that have made that descent, you know how staggering it is. And the wisdom that came to me was so clear, so clean, precise. The Grand Canyon is only grand because of what's been lost, not because of one thing that's been added. One particle of soil at a time, releasing, letting go into the water over the span of 5 million years. It's incomprehensible, swept away by something so simple as water. I spent that night at the Phantom Ranch at the bottom of the canyon. It's a charming, historic, albeit Spartan compound, dormitory-like cabins, communal dining room. That night, the lovely gentleman who served us dinner asked for our attention before we dug in. He wanted to offer us a kind of blessing or invocation. My friends, I want to welcome you here, and I hope that while you're here, you take some time to be still and quiet and feel the power of this place, the majesty of it, the sacredness of it. It's like Jerusalem or Mecca for the native people. He went on to say, and no matter how hard it was for you to climb down today, climbing up tomorrow is going to be so much easier. And of course, there were incredulous groans from around the dining table. Yeah, right. And if not, he said, rejoice, rejoice, you got no choice. I love that. I come back to it again and again as a kind of mantra. Rejoice, rejoice, you got no choice. What if, like the Grand Canyon, we are being carved out for our grandeur, hollowed out by loss, so that on our descent, we might get a glimpse every now and then of that which is indestructible. Sure, let's savor every vista, cherish every moment, hold on, you bet. But with an oh-so-light grasp and a willingness at any moment to let go, except perhaps or that one thing. So be it. Thank you.